Welcome to Movie Maniacs. Mike Rags and Chuck Curry discussing the greatest movies of all time and all the new films in theaters and streaming that you need to know about. Like us, rate us, share us. Now, here are your hosts, Mike Rags and Chuck Curry.
All right, we're back with another edition of Movie Maniacs. Wherever you found us, thank you. And of course, if you follow us on the podcast, share us with your friends, rate and review us, all that kind of fun stuff. And if you're listening on Whoa 1190 107.5 FM, welcome aboard. Yes, it is another quarantine edition of Movie Maniacs as theaters remain closed. We got some good news in Indiana we'll talk about in a couple of minutes. And Chuck is in northeastern Pennsylvania, if you don't know that by now. So that's where we are quarantining from and doing another show. We promised it last week. Al Pacino's birthday was a week ago, and we're going to do his 10 best movies coming up later on in the show. We've got some Fast Fives, which does include The Rock, believe it or not, Chuck. The Rock's birthday is this weekend, and a whole heck of a lot of fun. And for some reason, and somehow, I know Chuck's running two businesses, so he doesn't have time to binge watch. Chuck, you're one of the few Americans that haven't sat down in front of a TV and watched 10 episodes of something straight ahead.
Actually, you know what I did? I did watch it a little. My wife and daughter, when I come home, they've been rewatching Cobra Kai.
And,
I've seen it before, but I got to tell you, if you're a fan of The Karate Kid and you have not watched Cobra Kai, you got to watch it. I don't think they could have done a better job in terms of storytelling, homage, just give you the feel of what made that movie so special. And it advances on the story. I know we talked about this last year when it first aired, but it's just really good stuff.
Yeah, I still haven't gotten a chance to watch. Is it still only on YouTube? Is that the only place I can get it?
YouTube Red, I believe.
Oh boy, I gotta pay for that. I don't like paying for things, Chuck.
You do have to pay for it.
Bad enough.
And it is really good.
I'm actually watching a good series too with my daughter. It's called Home After Dark, which is on Apple Plus. Actually stars Jim Sturgess, who plays a dad who moves back to his hometown, who has a daughter who's 9 years old, who's a aspiring journalist trying to solve a murder mystery in that small town in Pacific Northwest. It's actually based on a true 9-year-old reporter, and it's actually quite entertaining, and we're in the middle of it now, so I would highly recommend that. It's called Home After Dark, and it's on Amazon Plus. And you know, Chuck, with the start of the new month, you get inundated with brand new shows up and down the pike, and it's hard to keep up. May 1st is here, and then there's 10 shows you need to watch. So we have the time, but I can't put the amount of effort they want us into all these shows. But it is quite incredible the amount of outlets and the amount of – and by the way, Peacock debuted now too, Chuck. That's NBC's streaming service.
And that's free, correct?
And that's free from Xfinity. If you have it on Xfinity, you get it for nothing. Although, I will tell you, I browsed through it today.
Yep.
Their selection is very limited right now. So they'll have Law & Order, but they'll only have like 7 seasons of Law & Order, not the entire show.
Okay.
So it has its limitations. I'm sure it's just getting off the ground. And I don't see The Office or Seinfeld there yet.
So the business model with that is commercials, correct?
Well, no. I haven't seen any. I haven't watched the show. I would think that there probably is since it was free.
Okay.
Much like Hulu, you got to pay a premium price
to
get the commercials out.
Yeah.
I would think maybe they'll go down that road. I don't know.
Well, they might go like Roku, where you just pop a commercial in just briefly.
Yeah, right? Like a 10-second ad. Like if you're watching something on YouTube, sure.
Right. You ever think we've been talking about all this streaming 5 years ago like this?
I mean, we brought it up, and we wondered where the business was going. This pandemic kind of kicked it in the ass and made it go down a certain road. I don't know if it's coming off that road, Chuck.
Well, let's bring up one of the big stories of this week: the Universal AMC feud that Regal has now got itself into. I'll start off. Story broke a few days ago, I guess at a shareholder conference. The CEO of Universal Pictures started to talk about the success in his mind of Trolls World Tour, which did not go to theaters because of Corona. It's an expensive animated film. It's a sequel, a highly anticipated sequel. It went straight to VOD. And I guess, according to his numbers, Trolls World Tour has done $100 million in VOD business in 3 weeks since it's been released in that format. to the CEO's glee. He said that was a really good number. They're very pleased with that. And then said going forward that Universal is examining its business model and would like to do theatrical and VOD primarily at the same time, which garnered the wrath of the CEO of AMC Theaters, who came out with a blistering statement stating that the way the contract is, there is a window, and if you release a movie theatrically and if AMC plays your movie, you cannot do VOD the same day. You have to honor the current window, which I believe is what it's over 30 days. And then AMC shot back. I mean, Universal shot back saying, well, certain movies will justify a theatrical and VOD release. And then Regal chain jumped in and fully backs AMC. My opinion on this is I completely side 99.9% with AMC, because here's the deal. Universal Pictures and AMC have been doing business for a century. That's 100 years, right? And the reality is, if studios want to do day-to-day, which is theatrical and VOD, that's called a double dip. And while they'll benefit tremendously from that, the theater chain will not. Meaning, whatever business goes to VOD, the theater ain't going to get a dime of that unless the contract is somehow rewritten. Now, I get the point of view of Universal stating that certain movies that are being produced now, they're not theatrical releases anymore, even though they're quality films. And we brought up the example last week of the Ben Affleck film, The Way Back. Really good movie. I think it'll be in my top five movies of 2020. I love that film. But the reality is, I could see that movie, to save marketing cost, being released straight to VOD and not playing theatrically. Having said that, Universal Pictures controls the rights to the Jurassic World franchise, Fast and the Furious. Fast and the Furious, the latest one, when it comes out next year, it's a billion-dollar entity theatrically, Mike, worldwide.
Yeah.
It's not doing $1 billion on VOD. It's not doing $500 million on VOD. Maybe it does $300,000 on VOD. It's not enough. So you can't have it both ways, in my opinion. Thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, unless you're on the argument is let's just make sure the movie gets to as many eyes as possible and as many people see it as possible. And sometimes it's not about the almighty dollar. We know that it is. But if I'm a director and I just want to make a movie that I want people to see, what do I care how it gets released? Just as long as it gets released on as many in as many ways as possible so people like it and enjoy it, right? I mean, isn't that the point of it all?
But under that, and I'm not, your statement is valid, but if you're AMC Theaters or you're any movie theater, Regal, Cinemark, right?
Right.
And Universal's going to release the next Fast and the Furious film. You need that movie to be solely a theatrical film with the window of VOD waiting. Because if you go same day, you're going to split the baby. So the studio is going to win-win, and the theater is going to erode.
Yeah, but
in
can't
terms
you just
of its
change?
Share.
At AMC is just going to have to change their business model.
How?
Less theaters, less. Maybe it's not $10 to see a movie on the big screen.
Yeah.
Maybe it's $5.
Why would they do that though? Why would they do that?
To compete. I mean, if these movies are going to go to stream for $6, and you don't have a choice.
Here's AMC's argument, which and you tell me who has the leverage here. AMC goes back to Universal and says, we are not booking. If you go that route, we're not playing your Fast and the Furious franchise. We're not playing your Jurassic Park franchise. We're not playing the next two Halloween movies.
You're cutting off the nose to spite your face. You're going to cut out the movies that people are going to go to your theaters to see. So why would you do that? I mean,
very, very simple. You're doing it because you're trying to force Universal Pictures to show your movies exclusively for the first 30 to 45 days in a theater setting. Once you break that window, you're basically ending theaters, Mike.
Yes.
It's just
yes,
a fact. That's a fact. So AMC and now Regal, I'm sure Cinemark will jump on this. They have no choice. They have to draw the hardest line imaginable in that sand. There can't be wiggle room here. Because once you give wiggle room, if you're not included in the pot, if the studio's not willing to give the theater a piece of the VOD, then basically you had a business. You've now stripped probably 30% of your market share in the blink of an eye. It's gone within one, once you agree to that. So I, from a business point of view, I completely understand AMC's tact here. I think considering that they did business for a century, and now you're trying to take. I understand the mindset there. The greed comes into play. The market's changed. The landscape has changed dramatically as we speak, and it changes on a daily basis. Having said that, you have to formulate basically the structure that's in place now, or theaters certainly will go by the wayside.
But as a movie maker and as a production studio, you have to cater what you do to what the mass audience, how they consume their product now. You can't worry about those movie theaters. You got to worry about how can as many people stream it, download it, see it as possible so I can make money. And 30 days in the theater might not be the way to do it. And they've got to look at that. When they release a movie,
agree. We agree to disagree vehemently on this because again, there's no possible way a movie could gross $1 billion worldwide if theaters went bye-bye and it was just a VOD format. It's just not going to happen. I don't know if we know that yet.
I don't know if we know that yet because it's not. We don't do that yet. You know what I'm saying?
Well, Trolls World Tour, 100 million in 3 weeks VOD. Right, production value has got to be right around there.
Sure.
Okay. So, not that they're really profitable on Trolls World Tour there. If that movie played worldwide in theaters, it's doing 300 to 500 million.
Right.
Let's say 350. 50-50 split. I don't know what the split is on VOD. I don't know what they got to give back to the distributor.
Yeah, I don't know either.
The entity, you know, the cable service or you know, iTunes, so on and so forth that does this stuff. So it's a really interesting topic, though.
Well, and it's an argument that's not going to go away because it's just it'll be a fight till the finish.
Yes, I agree.
And the virus score one for VOD because until we get back, and that's one of the things I want to bring up, Chuck, is in my state, the governor said – middle of June, half capacity movie theaters. And then July 4th, that weekend, first weekend in July, we're looking to get full capacity, everything. Okay. So we're releasing things in stages starting Monday, where it's you can gather with 25 people the first week, and then it's 100 the second 2 weeks after that.
So in Indiana, come Monday, going to a restaurant, what's the rule?
Restaurant, you go inside to pick up stuff. I don't believe you can eat inside yet. I think after 2 weeks, we can start eating inside, half capacity, no bar service. You can't sit at a bar.
You could go to a park and hang out with 10 people.
Yes, you can go. And then at the end of May,
mask
optional.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. And I think at the end of May, you'll see pools, parks, gyms, half capacity open up. So gradual, but we're going to get his end game is July 4th weekend. And if you look at the slate of releases, Chuck, again, there's really everything's either VOD or not coming out. And the next high profile, remember, Black Widow was supposed to open this weekend, the Marvel movie. Who knows when it's coming out now?
Now, let me ask you a question. If you were betting man, Wonder Woman 1984, I think it's supposed to come out in August. I'm gonna say a lot of stuff's gonna get kicked to next year. Am I wrong?
Or holidays, depending on where we're at.
Because here's the deal: without a vaccine, again, this is purely speculation from a business point of view. If I got a $200 million plus investment on Warner Brothers in Wonder Woman 1984, we get another surge of this. They pull things back. Boy, you're left with your pants down here.
Yeah, kinda.
So I could see almost everything getting kicked into 2021, and that's not good news for theaters.
Now, the next major, I say that in quotes, release that was supposed to come out now is VOD, and May 15th will be Scoob, Chuck. That's the origin story animated movie for Scooby-Doo. That would have made, much like Trolls, probably would have made some decent money at the box office, and it'll probably get the same kind of return on VOD now, but that's the next big release. And then you'll have Artemis Fowl come out in June on Disney Plus. By the way, kudos to Disney Plus. They bumped up Star Wars Rise of Skywalker to Disney Plus on Monday, 2 months ahead of schedule.
So yeah, I mean, they have the luxury of doing a lot of, unique things, primarily because their brand is built and they're trying to, you know, just add subscription to Disney Plus, which they're going to do. And this is all going to work. Long term, Disney is in better shape than any entity in the business.
Although their parks don't know what they're doing yet.
Yeah,
that is one big deal. And I would think one of their parks is located, it's interesting. One of their parks is located in Florida. One of their parks is located in California.
Right.
Complete opposite spectrums of where they are on the political side of things and how they're going to open up their states. Could they open one and not the other? I guess they could, right?
I doubt they would do that, though.
Yeah, very interesting where they're going to go down that road. By the way, Chuck, speaking of things in the movie news and that I watched, I don't know if you got a chance to see this, but the reunion of the Goonies cast on YouTube, hosted by Joss Gad.
How long was
it? It was a half hour.
Okay.
Happened last week.
Where'd they do? Where they do like a FaceTime
thing? Quarantined. Everybody, and I mean everybody alive involved with that project, was basically on this reunion. And it's fantastic. I would highly recommend you going back and watch it. They even even Richard Donner's there, who's 90 years old.
How was
his 90th birthday? He had a hard time connecting in the beginning, but he eventually came around. Spielberg was a part of it. Chris Columbus was a part of it. The Fratelli brothers, everybody is in it. Chuck, except, of course, John Matuszak and Ann Ramsey, who would have to come back from the grave to be a part of it. It's highly entertaining. They do talk about potential of a sequel and how hard it's been.
Mm-hmm.
And Spielberg makes a great point. He's like, the bar is set so high, it'd be like doing a sequel to The Wizard of Oz or something of that nature.
I wouldn't go that far.
Well, but the
But you could see the viability in this franchise is there.
It's still there. And
listen, they're going to reboot. They're going to do something with this franchise, especially after I'm sure fans would love to do a sequel, but I have a feeling the Bean Counters and Warner Brothers going forward would say, you know what? Let's just reboot this thing.
We
could churn out more than a few.
You watch the original and you see the cast. I don't know if there was any inclination, only maybe because of heritage of where Josh Brolin came from.
Yeah.
But the fact that he has become the most viable star out of all of them is quite remarkable.
You know what's interesting about Josh Brolin? He had the lead role in Jurassic World, and then for whatever reason bowed out, and then Chris Pratt came in and made Chris Pratt, you know, a major movie star.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And speaking of which, Parks and Recreation did their little quarantine episode too. It was quite entertaining as well, and he was a part of that as well. And you bring up Jurassic World, Chuck. We did actually lose a star from Jurassic World over the past week. Irfan Khan died at the age of 53.
Saw that. Awful.
Yeah, he had a tumor, brain tumor, I believe.
Yeah, awful.
And
really good.
So he's very good in Jurassic World.
He is really good in it.
His death scene is so good. I wish he would have lasted in the movie a little longer because I thought he added some gravitas to that movie.
Yeah.
And I actually loved him in Life of Pi.
Mm-hmm.
The last 10-minute speech that he gives at the end, maybe people should be watching right now, Chuck. Would you rather the positive side of things or the negative side of things? So Irfan Khan passed away at the age of 53. Chuck, some other movie news before we move forward with some Al Pacino's greatest. Thoughts on – now look, Now You See Me, Now You Don't. Now You See Me 1, 2. Those movies – look, they're viable. They're highly produced. There's great casts in it. Not much of a script. They rely too heavily on twists and turns and gimmicks. And it is a great cast, but they're lining up to do a third one, Chuck.
Yeah,
I kind of got through. The second one is hard to watch. It looks like the cast is going to be back for a third one. I don't know my thoughts on this. I love the cast, but I cannot get too juiced up for the same old magic tricks.
Yeah, me too. I mean, they're both very watchable films. It's a good cast.
And they're also anticipating another bit of movie news here, and I don't know how they know this, but maybe it's because people aren't going to be in theaters, but Christopher Nolan's Tenet is projecting a low box office opening. I would think most movies now, Chuck, brings up an interesting topic. They have to temper their expectations when a movie releases, when it finally does.
So you saw the tracking on it?
Right now, AMC, and a lot of it has to do with the battle between AMC and VOD. But
what's that release date?
July 24th was the original plan, and it was going to come out in IMAX and 70mm film, and you know how Nolan tries to do things. But you know what I'm saying? I mean, how you can't anticipate a huge opening anymore, I don't know if you can.
The production thing, a production budget on that thing, I hear is like $250 million.
Yeah. Well, again, I don't know. Would it? I mean, Interstellar opened huge, but only I don't know how much had to do with Christopher Nolan and sci-fi as it did Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah. Well, say, listen, you got to be nervous if your studio with product right now. I don't know what you do with it. I don't know if you just. Again, but that's going to put the theaters in dire straits. I mean, you could look just based off our conversation in the last 15 minutes. If you're theater owners, your theater chains in this country, it's a two-year cleanup, Mike.
It is.
To a point.
You got any other movie news?
I do this week in, let's just bounce off this real quick. This week in history, May 1st, 1939, Batman, the character of Batman, first appeared in Detective Comics issue number 27, created by Bob Kane. Batman has become a staple in film. Hard to believe, goes back to Adam West in the 1960s, playing Bruce Wayne Batman, and then Tim Burton in 1989, which really, beside Richard Donner, elevated what we see now in terms of the comic book movie craze. Hard to believe you got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 actors who played Batman on film, and the seventh to be Robert Pattinson. You had Adam West, Michael Keaton, Val Kilmer, George Clooney, Christian Bale, Ben Affleck, and now Robert Pattinson Batman, which will come out October of next year. Time flies, Mike.
Does it count when Alfred dressed up as Batman in the original TV series? Does that count or no?
No.
It's hard to believe 81 years, though. You're right. That's incredible stuff.
My favorite superhero, by the way.
You know, I think anybody who listens to this show would know that by now. All right, Chuck, let's move forward with some Fast Five here. And we'll start with a legendary actress who's still alive. Matter of fact, I got a chance to watch I Can Only Imagine last week from last year. And I was shocked at how much this movie affected me. I'm not a big Christian movie fan, and I wasn't expecting much for this film. I did remember you liking it a lot last year and telling me it was pretty good. I watched it streaming, and Cloris Leachman is in it. That's why I bring it up. But boy, oh boy, this movie really got to me, and there wasn't a dry eye in the house, Chuck. It was a pretty good movie. I Can Only Imagine, of course, based on the Christian rock singer and band that wrote the song and why he wrote the song. But boy, Dennis Quaid does some of his best work in quite some time in this movie.
Who rounds out the cast in that film?
No one.
Dennis Quaid?
Movie. I thought you saw this movie and liked it.
Oh, okay. I thought you were talking about that. Yeah, no. I did like that film. That was about a year ago, right?
Yeah.
No, I like that film a lot. Actually, of all the Christian theme based films, I thought this was the best one.
Yeah, this was really good.
No,
so
it was
I bring
good.
It up because Cloris Leachman is in it. She's 90 some odd years old. She's 94 years old this weekend. Cloris Leachman, obviously she was Phyllis back on the big, Mary Tyler Moore show.
She was.
She's fantastic in a ton of Mel Brooks movies
She's good in every Mel Brooks movie. They're all good.
Is there any movie, because that's the idea of Fast
How
Five.
How about Young Frankenstein?
All right, that's a good one. I actually loved her in High Anxiety. I would go that way with Cloris Leachman. All right, Chuck, how about Kirsten Dunst, who is, 38 years old this weekend. She's been around a long time. Remember, she's just a kid in Interviewing with a Vampire. She's very good in that movie.
And Jumanji, she's just a kid too.
Jumanji as well. She's also in the Small Soldiers. Remember, she's in that film, which was also a very good movie. Is there something outside of Bring It On for me Or is it Mary Jane and the Spider-Man movies?
I mean, I'll go with Spider-Man 2. She, you know, some people, I remember her casting gave her some flack. You know, that's not Mary Jane, blah, blah, blah. Well, she's a little bit more Mary Jane than Zendaya is Mary Jane, you know, the variation of Mary Jane. I like her as Mary Jane in the Spider-Man universe, especially in 1 and 2. I think her scenes with Tobey Maguire feel pretty real and moving. She's good in those movies.
She's good in mostly everything she does. And that's why Bring It On went on to make a tremendous amount of money back in 2000.
Sure did. Sure did.
All common high school comedy ended up being almost a cult classic to some people. All right, Chuck, how about Uma Thurman, who is 50 years old this week. Uma Thurman, an iconic actress as well. You say her name and a number of roles pop up, mostly maybe Tarantino-ish, Kill Bill, or go back to
Pulp Fiction.
To Pulp Fiction. Is there one Uma Thurman movie that sticks out for you?
No, not really.
So not even Pulp Fiction.
Well, I like Pulp Fiction a lot, but you know, I'm not the biggest Kill Bill fan. Those movies never rub me the right way. I don't know. But she's she's really good in those movies. It's just
tremendous.
I'm not aching to do rewatching though.
Not even going to bring up her turn as the villainess Poison Ivy.
No.
I'm trying to find some. Oh, I know one that I love. Beautiful Girls. She's
Beautiful
the Girls.
Girl. I was thinking of that too. Yeah, I like that movie. It's a good movie a lot.
All right, two more, Chuck, and now we're getting into more high profile actors and actresses to help you out here a little bit. Michelle Pfeiffer, nominated for 3 Oscars. Obviously, first popping up on the scene when back in the day of Scarface and Grease 2, back to back. Good way to start your career. Michelle Pfeiffer's a number of iconic roles. Which one stands out for you?
I mean, pop culture-wise, you know, her turn as Selina Kyle, Catwoman, and Batman Returns, that made her a major – I mean, she was a star, but I think that has solidified her as a, you know, major name in the industry. She's worked consistently for, you know, 30-plus years. She's done a lot of good work. Fabulous Baker Boys, obviously. Mm-hmm. Really good film. Got her a lot of acclaim. You know, and unlike Jessica Lange, who laid an egg, you know, in some people's eyes, laid an egg with King Kong. I never thought that. I always liked her throughout. But Michelle Pfeiffer has been a mainstay in feature film for a very long time, and she's still going strong.
And one of the few actors or actresses that are in both the DC world and the Marvel world. Remember, she is the original Wasp, and she was Catwoman. So she is an Avenger, so to speak, Chuck, in a roundabout way. Let's not forget.
Okay.
I'm going to go with a movie called, you know, and I really liked her. I think Grease 2 is one of the more underrated movies ever made, to be
really?
Honest. People hate that movie, but go back and watch it. There's a lot of fun and energy, and there's a tremendous
energy.
Energy?
I don't know. To me, it feels flat as a pancake.
Well, when was the last time you go back
you
and watch?
You must be watching a different film.
You've got nothing else to do, but I also liked her opposite Robert Redford in Up Close and Personal.
I like that film, too. Yeah, I do. That's a nice movie.
Yeah.
I like it.
All right, Chuck. Last but not least, the actor, wrestler, icon, The Rock, who is really just unbelievable.
What's his real name?
Dwayne Douglas Johnson.
All right.
Former football player, turned wrestler.
He's done okay. He's done okay for himself.
And he's only 48 years old, believe it or not.
Yeah.
All right. So which Rock movie is the best Rock movie?
It's for me, it's San Andreas. I guess I'm partial to disaster films, but I thought he was tremendously likable in that film, and I was enveloped in the bombastic storyline. It's not as grounded in any sense of reality like maybe the 74 earthquake was with Charlton Heston and George Kennedy. And it's over the top, and it's earthquake on steroids times 100. But I thought it was a blast and a lot of fun. And I like the entire cast of that film. And I enjoy that on repeat viewing. San Andreas, to me, has a lot of repeat viewing ability. And I just, if it pops on or if it comes on cable, it hooks me. I like that one the best of all the stuff he's done.
Yeah, that's probably my pick as well. Although I will say he really did good work in Be Cool. Although
no, he did. He's good. He's definitely the career. You don't become what he's become if you don't have a lot of the intangibles. He's charismatic. He can act. He's a great screen presence. I think one of the issues with what they've done with him is they've made him a super. They made him a human superhero without a cape. In a lot, like if you go to
Skyscraper,
now it's a very watchable movie, and I do get some enjoyment pleasure out of it. But why not make that movie more grounded, like The Towering Inferno, and have him play a real character, instead of fighting a fire in a skyscraper, you know, he's beating the hell out of it, like
on one leg, he jumped from a scaffold.
Yeah.
Through, I would say maybe what 200 feet he flew in the air and went into the building.
And you say to yourself, the screen first. It's got to start with the screenwriter, right? And then it starts with. Then it goes to the director and the producers. And you say to yourself, they're not confident in today's movie-going audience to tell a layered story. I mean, here you got a good. He's a good actor, great screen presence, charismatic. Why not play a real person? Why do you got to have him flying around? It's not believable.
Well, I would venture to guess, and it'd be funny to find out what came first, the chicken or the egg here, though.
Yeah.
They had a script, then they got The Rock, and then they're saying, well, we've got to put the elements in this movie that would be Rock-like stuff. You know, or did they have The Rock from the beginning, then they're like, all right, go write a script around the fact that The Rock is going to be the guy scaling the building here. Yeah. I'm not sure how that came about, but I'm sure if
Can you imagine if they had Steve McQueen or Paul Newman doing that stuff in 74?
Forget it.
The audience was walked out.
Although Robert Vaughn tried to do it and
didn't work, though.
Unsuccessful.
Yeah.
And Jennifer Jones also tried.
Yeah. Also, they didn't stay elevated as long as The Rock, I could tell you that.
No doubt about it. All right, Chuck, you did pretty good with Fast Five there. Although,
but I just want to point out one thing with Dwayne Johnson. The biggest career movie, when he got involved in the Fast and the Furious films,
sure,
that really elevated him to the highest of levels.
Well, and let's face it, he still stays involved with the WWE. He had Ballers on HBO.
Yeah.
He had a show on NBC where he was getting people
in shape.
And the guy is a multimedia superstar.
Absolutely.
And I don't begrudge him at all because I find him highly appealing.
I do too.
All right, Chuck. Also, someone that I find highly appealing.
He's no Roddy Piper, though.
No Roddy Piper.
Okay.
I don't think Al Pacino, if they had Al Pacino attached to Skyscraper, he would have been doing some of the things The Rock was doing.
He would have said hoo-ah in a very different way.
He would have blew out the fire.
It's getting hot in here.
Hoo-ah.
It's getting hot in here.
I'm going to take a flamethrower. Yeah. Anyway, we're getting off tangent. Yeah, but it's the 10 best movies of Al Pacino. And I might have recency bias because I went back and watched one of these.
You did.
But it's so good that I'm glad I did watch it again. But you talk about a guy who's, I mean, six decades of great work, basically, at least five of them. He kind of became a caricature of himself after Scent of a Woman, Chuck, and most of his movies.
So what you're saying, he's a little bit over the top at Scent of the Woman, and he got his Oscar for that film.
He did. Not his best role, but it's on my list. Not his best role, but and then he just started making movies where all he would do, like, would yell at some point in time.
Why do you think he did that?
I think it just became his shtick, right? I mean, that's why he was getting cast. Like when he plays the devil in The Devil's Advocate, a movie I enjoyed.
Yeah, I do too. I mean,
he basically came off of Scent of a Woman and said, well, how can I do the same character with a little twist? And I don't know. His later work's been really good, and we'll get to it in a bit. But obviously, most known for The Godfather.
And Jack and Jill. Let's point that out.
Jack and Jill.
I just want to preface again before we start this.
Can I ask you a question though before you do that? Obviously, always teamed up with De Niro. They're always compared. Which movie's worse, 15 minutes or 88 minutes?
I'll go with 88.
Yeah, only because it's longer, right?
Yeah, probably.
Oh, boy. Anyway.
But here's the thing. If I ever thought I'd see the guy who was in The Godfather 1 and 2 playing himself so over the top in that Adam Sandler movie, Jack and Jill, I wouldn't believe it.
It's amazing.
But it happened.
It goes to show you the charisma Adam Sandler must have to be able to talk an actor like that into doing something like that.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, he's having fun. I guess the mortgage was due.
The mortgage. Everybody's got a mortgage. It always is. All right, Chuck. We've got to go through our 10 through 5 here. And we always, well, not always, but a lot of times we take liberties in what we do. But let me know your thoughts on my 10 through 6 here. I said 5, 6. And let me know what you think. And I'm going to go with this HBO trilogy of biopics as my number 10. He played Joe Paterno. He played Jack Kevorkian. He played Phil Spector. And he nailed all three roles. The same guy does all three. And they're very highly entertaining biopics. My number 9 is Ocean's 13, his turn as the bad guy in the Ocean's 11 series. I loved his work in the epic Irishman. I thought he was the best out of all the actors in that film. I loved the Scorsese's, basically, let's call it a mini series that turned into a film. But I thought he was fantastic in that. Scent of a Woman would be my number 7. And then maybe a little-known Christopher Nolan film, really the first time he hit U.S. mainstream audiences with his films, and that's Insomnia.
Yep.
Pacino plays a cop who goes to Alaska to try to find a serial killer.
Great atmosphere.
Robin Williams. Great movie. Teams up with Hilary Swank in that film, too. Guy can't get to sleep at all because it's always daylight, Chuck. I love that movie. So it's the HBO trilogy, Ocean's 13, The Irishman, Scent of a Woman, and Insomnia, my 10 through 6.
They're all good. I didn't think about the fact they did those three HBO films. I knew the Joe Paterno one popped into my head first because that's the last one that he did. But that was good work. My 10 through 6, I got 10 is Insomnia. Really good film.
Yeah.
It's when Robin Williams started to take some real chances in his feature film work. Number 9, Scent of a Woman. Yeah, he is over the top, but it's an entertaining movie. Number 8, See a Love. Played a cop a lot, Mike. He really did.
His pairing with John Goodman,
Ellen Balkin. It was a big hit, that movie, by the way.
Yeah, it was a bit of a comeback movie for him as well. And I'll get to that later on because it's higher on my list.
Number 7, Glengarry Glen Ross. I love that film. Great ensemble. One of the great ensembles of all time. And that's one of those movies, if you haven't seen it, that is absolute must-see viewing for great acting. Jack Lemmon, Alec Baldwin. My number 6, Carlito's Way. You know what? Carlito's Way is an interesting movie because the first time I saw that film, I was sort of mixed, but over time, it's really grown on me. And if you watch a trailer on YouTube, it's one of the best trailers you'll ever see cut for a film. Yeah, it gives away most of the movie, but the score in the trailer, it's a Brian De Palma movie. It's very poetically done, and I like that character a lot in the overall arc of Pacino's career. So number 10, Insomnia. Number 9, Scent of a Woman. Number 8, See a Love. Number 7, Glengarry Glen Ross. And number 6, Carlito's Way.
A couple of those movies on my list. I think Carlito's Way, you're right. Somehow it does grow on you in a way. It ends on such a downer, too. You don't walk out of the theater thinking about it as a De Palma at his best, especially that last 15-minute scene is vintage.
And remember when Penelope Ann Miller was the name in the business back then?
Yes. And Sean Penn, almost unrecognizable in that film, too.
Yes.
Not on my list, though. And, you know, what's interesting, your number 7, I believe, Glengarry Glen Ross is my number 5. But before we get to that, some people might be surprised Scent of a Woman is not higher for either one of us.
Yeah.
And I think part of that movie, and it's directed by Martin Brest, it's a really good movie.
Because I'm going to tell you why. Because
two
I like
films in one.
It's, yeah.
It drags a little. It's a little too long. Mm-hmm. And more than anything else, it was more of a Lifetime Achievement Award for Al Pacino.
I think so. And I like Mike Pacino a little bit more grounded, which is his stuff in the 70s versus over the top stuff in the last few decades.
Yeah. And I did like the end scene, though, when he's in the courtroom or whatever the hell that was with Chris O'Donnell and proving it is. And he takes, I'll take a blowtorch of this whole thing. So, all right, my number 5 is Glengarry Glen Ross. His role as Roma in that film, when he tells off Kevin Spacey at the end of the film, when he blows the sail for him, what a great scene.
It's a great movie. The atmosphere in that movie is just – and if you're ever involved in the world of sales –
Patel.
Oh, it's good.
You give me these dead leads, Chuck. I mean,
he gives him two leads in the home. Two leads.
And he's not the best actor, and it's Jack Lemmon, but he certainly does stand out in a great cast of characters. So my number 5 is Glengarry Glen Ross.
Great pick. My number five, I went with Serpico, one of his early stuff in the 70s, playing, you know, based on the true story of a real-life detective in New York City. Really layered, fascinating subject matter about police corruption. Was very well acclaimed back in the day. It was a hit, totally character-driven. Pacino carries the day. This is when acting was acting, Mike, and where, you know, movies didn't rely on CGI or explosions or big action scenes. It just relied on great storytelling, fantastic screenplays, great direction, and great lead acting. And Serpico fits the bill in spades here.
And great supporting casting without getting big name. I mean, you talk about the New York actors that were involved in that movie along with Pacino. It feels like he's really a cop in that world.
Oh, absolutely.
Over 2 hours.
And the stakes are real.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like, okay, you don't know what's going to happen in these type of films.
No, you don't. You don't. It's not on my list, but it barely missed my list. Chuck, my number four, it's interesting. We're talking about his over-the-top roles after Son of the Woman. His best role after Son of the Woman is when he keeps it all inside and becomes a bit of an introvert. And it's that gangster film, Donnie Brasco, opposite Johnny Depp. It's just a fantastic film. And he plays a character who's kind of a pretty much a lifetime loser, Chuck, mm-hmm. trying to wiggle his way through the crime world and survive. And Donnie Brasco, obviously the undercover agent that takes everything down. I thought his inside voice came out a lot in that film and not the hoo-ahs. And it was refreshing to see that from him at that point in his career, because he hadn't been doing that kind of stuff, and is actually its most subdued role since Michael Corleone in Godfather 2. A lot of it is internal, and a lot of it is very effective, and a great ending to this film, too. It's basically my favorite Johnny Depp movie as well. I love Donnie Brasco, my number three.
It's my number three also.
My number four, sorry.
No, it's my number three. I love this film. And Anne Heche is fantastic in this movie also, is the wife of the Johnny Depp character. This is a great movie. And again, it's good to see Pacino playing layered, more low-key, doing some real acting. It's a fantastic story. It's one of the best mob movies of all time, in my opinion. I put it easily in the top 10 of all mob pictures.
You go into that movie, you're thinking you're going to be the antagonist, and the person you're going to be rooting for is the FBI agent. And it isn't that. You actually start rooting for the Pacino character, and you want him to get out of his own way sometimes. And
yes,
it's really done good. My number three, I'm sure it's on your list. If not, I'd be shocked, is the other gritty New York City crime movie he did with Serpico, and that's Dog Day Afternoon, as a would-be bank robber on a hot day in New York, Chuck, and Charles Durning as the cop trying to thwart him, and Chris Sarandon as his gay lover, and so on and so forth. A lot of New York actors in that. Attica, an iconic role for an iconic actor, and that is Dog Day Afternoon. And that is one of those movies, Chuck, and it's weird, because that's one of those movies, and this doesn't happen a lot.
Sidney
Lumet. How many times you watch it, you forget how it ends.
Yeah.
And you forget where the resolution is going to be. That's how effective this movie is, because you get so enraptured in the acting and the writing that you almost forget the big payoff.
Great movie. It's my number two. Again, they don't make movies. Like, here's the thing about Dog Day Afternoon. Think about this. Think about the extended dialogue sequences in this film that he's rattling off. How many actors could do that? I wonder how many takes they did to get this right. And then, of course, you had Charles Durning, who's fantastic in this film.
Great.
All the actors. And again, that subplot that they drop on you with the Chris Sarandon character.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, this is a fascinating, fascinating movie. And it envelops you. And it leaves you, because most people walking into a movie theater back in the day watching this film, they don't really know how the movie's going to play out, even though it's based on a factual story. And they're like, how's this going to go? You know, where's this going to go? And it goes places that literally pull you in. And that's a fantastic screenplay, great direction, great acting. And again, when we say they don't make movies like this anymore, they don't. My number two.
Not only that, it's again, we talk about taking a Pelham 1-2-3 all the time about how
great movie, man.
New York movie that is.
Yes.
This is a quintessential.
Absolutely. You bring up two great ones.
And it's everything about it How can you not love Chuck? All right, I think we might have skipped your number three.
Yeah, my number four. Two. My number four we skipped. I went with Scarface. Yeah, he's a little bit over the top as Tony Montana, but it's a Brian De Palma film directed. Oliver Stone wrote the screenplay. This movie has pop culture ramifications as much as any film in the last 30 years, Mike. I mean, the people who find this movie, search this movie out, watch this movie three times a year, as much as any film. Scarface, great score. I think it's a great message of the rise and fall of greed and doing things that make you big money that you're not supposed to be doing. Michelle Pfeiffer's in that film. This is a fantastic story. I'm a big fan. Yeah, he's a little bit over the top, but still a great film. My number four.
Why do you think? And we know The Godfather's same way. Why do you think that crime boss and that role has stood the test of time as much as it has? I mean, what is it about?
Probably because I think the evolution of the gangster film has one basic element, and that is the dream of easy money, right? People, you know, the reason capitalism is able to stand the way it stands is because even though only a certain small percentage of the populace ever really hits big, that dream to hit big is always there. It's ingrained in the psyche of all humanity, right? And capitalism thrives in this country because people want to make, a lot of people want to make money to for their security. They want to make big money to have infinite pleasure. And when you see a character like Tony Montana, you know, a guy basically from nothing who winds up gaining tremendous access to big money, even though he's doing it in a horrible way, as a cocaine dealer, it still has some sort of fantasy appeal to a lot of people. And I don't think they're watching this movie to watch that character fall, Mike.
Well, that's the ironic thing.
That's the ironic thing about it.
These movies always end the same way.
Yes, they do. But I think people, they go along for the ride up until that point, and they like that ride. And that's sort of just the byproduct of it. And they accept that way. And, you know, if you look at Scorsese, all the gangster films he's done, it's always the same message. Crime ultimately doesn't pay. But when you're going along for the ride, I guess it's enjoyable to in that fantasy part of the mind.
It's a trade-off because that most of those same people would say, I'd do it all over again, right? They just to live that lifestyle. So, and I guess these movies show us a way to live that lifestyle without having to get a bullet in the back of the head.
I guess so.
All right, Chuck. Moving along, on my list is number two, and you brought it up in your other top 10, and I just watched it again, but I remember his role as Frank Keller in Sea of Love really getting to me, frankly, because we hadn't seen him on screen in quite some time, hadn't seen him as a New York cop in quite some time, and it actually, directed by Harold Becker, who was a real good director at the time, really engaged me into an apropos thriller. Ellen Barkin, opposite him, as a is-she-or-isn't-she killer, of men in New York City. That genre kind of played out a lot in the mid-80s, Chuck, about femme fatale and whether they're bad or not.
What year was that?
85, I believe.
Okay, so Basic Instinct was in 92, I think, right?
Yeah, and you also had like Black Widow, which came
out.
And things of that nature. But this one, it's gritty, has a lot of great dialogue in it as well. And John Goodman as his partner is very good. And first time you really see him in that type of role on the big screen. But Pacino carries the film, Chuck. You believe that he is every inch of this alcoholic cop just trying to figure out who the killer is. And the killer, it doesn't cheat at the end. I thought it actually did pay off pretty well on who the killer was and where this character almost has a bit of redemption from becoming an alcoholic, divorced guy who's on the brink of retiring into figuring out, you know what, I can embrace who I am now and live another life from here on out. And Pacino does that perfectly. And he got raves. The movie, like you said, was a hit as well.
It was a hit, yeah.
And a lot of it has to do with the fact that people were glad that he was back and that he was in a role that fit him like a glove.
Agree. I remember when this movie was reviewed, a lot of the critics saying, you know, Pacino's back on track. Because in those days, they wanted, you know, they looked at the, they looked at the industry different. Critics, certain actors, they wanted to completely put in a box where if they're not making the most high quality product possible, it's a complete misfire. And now we see it's a different landscape where actors and actresses make a lot of misfires. But yeah, it's a good film. It was a big hit and another staple in his overall canon of film.
And he, it's smart for him too, to see this script and know, look, if I'm going to come back, it's got to be something like this. Mm-hmm. No, because this is quintessential Pacino at his best. And he's not over the top. He does have some over the top scenes, but this is him in a nutshell, and it was perfect.
I think we're both on the same page as our number one. I put Godfather 1 and 2 as the same movie because they really are. It's really one long movie. Not three as much because I was two decades after the fact. And the quality, while a lot of it's really good, it's not in the same vein. Is Godfather 1 and 2. You could argue maybe the two best movies ever made right there in the top 10 of the two best movies ever produced. And the interesting part about his character of Michael Corleone, this is a hypnotic performance, a character of power, and a character that is also a little bit scary, Mike.
Yeah, and it's weird because, and obviously it's my number one too, because in one, he's basically an observer. He's just watching everything.
You see him growing.
You see him growing. You see him learning. See how he would do things if I ever got in control. And he's watching everything. So
in a very real way. Because the thing about the Godfather films, they're a very different texture than what Scorsese did say in Goodfellas.
Right.
And they play differently. But the subtext, the layer, not and Goodfellas is every bit as good as any gangster film ever made. I'm not trying to disconnect the two, but they are different.
The glitz and glamour isn't there. It's more of a, how would I run a business this way?
And it's done through the eyes of the mafia being a pure business.
Right, exactly.
With the nasty stuff around the edges, which they justified in their mind in a more real context than a lot of other gangster films.
Yes, and having Brando as Vito Corleone actually, helps in that, make it legitimate business. He's really good in it. But Pacino in two takes it to another level. Takes the business to another level as well. I mean, let's face it, you kill your brother, you're going to another level, Chuck. There's no doubt about that.
One of the more psychologically powerful sequences of all time in any movie. And, when he gets that order.
Because I thought his performance in three was just as good as any other. It's a little bit over the top.
Oh, it's a lot of bit over the top.
Yeah, he plays Pacino more than Corleone. But
I also think that's part of the plot device that the screenplay gives him. He's now diabetic.
Yeah.
You know, he's ill. He has these episodes where he just, goes into seizure. And it plays a little weird in the context of what you remember from one and two.
It does, and ultimately he meets his fate finally in that film as well. But he does have an iconic line in that film. Let's face it. Once I thought that was out, they pulled me back in.
Oh, absolutely. But we've talked about that film many times on the show. We do believe the juice of that movie is Andy Garcia.
No doubt
about it. In that film.
And the scenes they have together.
It's Pacino's Pacino, but the scenes they have together are really good. But the juice of that film is Andy Garcia.
It makes you wonder, no Andy Garcia, that movie would have got ripped to shreds even more if he was not in that film, if he wasn't cast in that, and it didn't have that kind of dynamic individual. Overall, surprised, Revolution, not in your top 10 either. He's made some stinkers, too, and most recently I saw him in a movie called Hangman that came out, I believe, a year or so ago. Again, he's a cop in it. Again, it's a serial killer, and again, it's bad. But
80 years old.
Heat didn't make our list. Very good in that.
And, of course.
Frankie and Johnny, he's done some light work, too, that's been appealing as well. But
His best is the 70s, though.
Really is.
Oh, because they don't – listen, my argument is that the golden age of cinema, for me, my taste, is the 70s. I think the way movies were written, the way they're directed, the characterization, the layerization of character doesn't get better.
No, and I think the reason why Donnie Brasco is so high on both of
feels
our lists,
like a 70s film.
It's a 70s movie stuck in modern day. There's
yeah, I agree.
There's no doubt about it. All right, Chuck, let's go through our list one more time here before we wrap up. Of my top 10, starting at number 10 is the trio of HBO films, Paterno, You Don't Know Jack, and Phil Spector. Ocean's 13, at number 9. The Irishman at 8, Scent of a Woman at 7, Insomnia at 6. Again, that movie we both brought up, and I bet you a lot of people not only forgot about it, but forgot that Christopher Nolan directed it, and Robin Williams is the bad guy in it, so I'd go back and recommend it. 5, Glengarry Glen Ross. 4, Donnie Brasco. 3, Dog Day Afternoon. 2, Sea of Love. And the number 1, The Godfather Trilogy.
Good list, Mike. My number 10, Insomnia. Number 8, Scent of a Woman. Number 10, Insomnia. Number 8, Scent of a Woman. Number 10, Insomnia. Number 9, Scent of a Woman.
There
number
8, go.
Sea of Love. 7 is Glengarry Glen Ross. Number 6, Carlito's Way. Number 5, Serpico. 4, Scarface. 3, Donnie Brasco. 2, Dog Day Afternoon. Number 1, Godfather 1 and 2. Basically, one long, great masterpiece of a film.
You might say the same thing about this podcast. One great, long masterpiece of a podcast and show. I don't know about the long
Agree.
Part. We did wrap it one time, so I don't know about the long part. All right, Chuck. We'll do this all over again next week, my friend. Stay healthy on your end of the country.
You too, Mike. And to everybody listening, stay safe. Be safe. See you next week.
This has been a presentation of Opt-In Productions. Thanks for listening to Movie Maniacs. Be sure to subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts. Download one of our archived episodes or listen to our next new podcast Friday. Podcasts by Federated Media. Podcasts by Federated Media.